you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
America rewards optimism, cheeriness, moderation. Well, a new book called The Upside of the Dark Side, subtitle, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Quote-Unquote Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. Well, that book argues that you're more likely to be successful and feel good about yourself and your own your life if you, as appropriate, invoke less societally encouraged behaviors like anger, anxiety, guilt, even narcissism. That in fact, preternaturally happy people in certain situations, at least at work, may be at a disadvantage. The book's senior author, Todd Kashtan, he is professor of psychology and senior scientist at the Center for the Advancement of Well-Being at George Mason University. His honors include the Distinguished Faculty Member of the Year at George Mason and Distinguished Scientific Early Career Award from the American Psychological Association National Award. So, Todd Kashtan, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Great. Well, you're not saying, let's get some misconception out of the way right away. You're not saying that positive emotions like happiness or mindfulness or being supportive of people, though, you're not saying those are bad, right?
No. In fact, I mean, Robert and I have done a lot of the research suggesting that we know that being grateful makes us more likely to pay it forward and be kind to other people. We know that humor in a work meeting can bring down the tension and the toxicity in a room. We know that when we meet a customer for the first time, that a lollipop often works better than a firm handshake and sort of setting the situation such that someone's going to be more benevolent, more willing to share, more generous. And so all of these positive quote, aspects of our personality are exactly what we want most of the time, and whether it's parenting, friends, work, or any domain.
Yeah. But the problem is that we genuflect before such positive behaviors and often fire people who dare demonstrate anger as we define them as out of control. We narcissistic people, oh my God, they're not a team player. So in other words, like a fine spice, you're saying that occasionally those behaviors that are perceived as absolute no-nos really have a place. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah. And we could even go further than that and say that in certain situations, exactly how we want to behave, how we want others to behave, and how we want to feel is exactly diametrically opposite than feeling good and being a kind, compassionate person. And the most successful people are ones that are able to appreciate all the different sides of their personality and not prematurely ripping out parts of their personality because people say, that's not very a cool part, that's not a socially acceptable part, or it doesn't feel good when I feel angry or when I'm feeling like as I'm acting selfishly and taking time for myself away from my kids.
Well, that's
saying, what if you honored it all?
Yeah, well, look, you know, that sounds great in theory. It's great for you. You got tenure. But the reality is anger is in so many workplaces a no-no. Indeed, it can get you fired. Let's say you realize that sometimes maybe it would be wise, you've got a lazy employee you've had it and you figure that all the nicey-nicey talk has not resulted in anything other than further laziness, and so you make a calculated decision even to be angry. And then that worker says, this person is vile in temper, and then you get fired. I mean, how do you deal with this in the real world?
Oh, no, it's a great question. I mean, one thing that's important about is, we're not talking about being an angry person. We're talking about strategically using anger. And anger isn't just rage and, you know, Lou Ferrigno turning into the Incredible Hulk. It's frustration. It's being pissed. It's being upset. And this is, if you don't communicate that someone violated your standards of how people are supposed to behave, if you don't tell your romantic partner that you get upset when they start talking to someone at a party and pretend you're not there when you're standing right next to them, you're not going to have a healthy, functional, long-term relationship. And you are not going to have respect from your colleagues, and you're going to have a place to be creative and think for yourself in whatever way works for you if you don't communicate to your coworkers or your boss that you're upset that they're not honoring that the way you work best is when you have some time to yourself away from other people, or the way you work best is in group settings, or the way you work best is to be able to do it at nighttime and not 9 to 5, and expressing your anger as your piss.
Well, it's It's easy to say these things that you're in control and be moderate, but most people, when they really legit, you know, it's fine to say we're going to use it as a tool. But most people don't use anger as a tool. There are certain categories of people who go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, and for them, they get furious. There is one thing that you, a technique that you have, that you mention in the book, that I think helps perhaps reduce the risk of you getting in deep doo-doo at work, and that is this. You know, I know that I should be calm here, but frankly, this is really getting to me. And so you're going to forgive me if my communication is not as moderate as the corporate culture requires us, but here is why I'm annoyed. And those few seconds not only sets the stage for legitimating your anger, but it gives you a couple of seconds to keep your anger at that moderate level that you described, you know, perturbed, rather than furious and explosive. Do you think that's the best preemptive solution?
Yeah, I would do a slight modification, which is you want to tell someone is, I was hesitant to spring this up, but I've been so anxious all day about even talking about this, but it's been bothering me too much not to talk about this.
Yeah.
And when you have this caveat, what happens is people's defenses come down. They feel sympathy for you, and at that moment, you now have the opening where you can say, like, listen, there was something that you said in front of the other members of our group, our team, that really, to be frank, pissed me off.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, you have you've given yourself buy-in, and you're allowed to be upset. You know, it's an important thing, and you're right that I have tenure, and so maybe I'm not the right person to be talking about this, but I worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange before I was in psychology, and I've worked for a law firm before I was in psychology, so I know what it's like to be in a place where tenure doesn't exist. And, you know, one of the reasons that I've often moved up the ranks is because I am candid and kind, and I don't choose between the two. And when I say candid, I mean I'm straightforward and harsh when necessary. And I remember I worked in a law firm in Long Island. It's one of the top 6 law firms, and there was a senator who was one of the lawyers there. And I was the only person, because I was young and a little bit, you know, arrogance at the time in my 20s, I asked them, hey, is it okay if I call you Norm? Because when I call you Senator Blank, you know, it takes so long and I feel as if we can't have a straightforward conversation. I asked, and he said yes. And all the lawyers were upset at me because everyone deferred to him as Senator and I called him Norm. And having those kind of frank, candid styles of communicating allows you to break through the barriers where people don't say what's really on their mind. And so it happens in the back rooms. It happens at the Irish pub after work. And my suggestion for leadership, which is the same as Pixar, when they talk about how their company is able to produce so many hits, is you want the candor and the dislike and the upsetness to happen in the room with the people there, not gossiping behind the scenes.
You know, calling the senator by the first name, that's easy, to be honest. But let's say you thought that, like so many politicians, he was full of it, and he was posturing and evading the questions and whatever. And the corporate normal way to do it would be say, you know, I feel I'm having a little concern that perhaps we're moving a little off topic. I wonder if you might more directly, you know, that's what is acceptable. But what if you did what you wrote in your book, which is you've got this what you call a microaggression. You push your hands forcefully against the table or you tighten your hands in the fist. And then you say, you know what? I think we're wasting a lot of high-priced people, lawyers' time here. You know, you understood the question. You're not a dummy. What would you please answer the question? You would be in deep trouble. Isn't that correct?
Well, the thing is, the wording in that example, I mean, I'm a big fan of Nietzsche, of language dictates consciousness. The wording in that one takes anger up a couple notches so that they become defensive. Let me just give you another concrete example of my own life, which is one of the things in academics, like many business environments, is older men are a little bit predatory towards attractive, intelligent, younger women in the workplace. And it's because I'm raising 3 daughters, I'm very sensitive to this issue. and I'm very outspoken about this. And I've confronted several scientists who have slept with their students. But I don't. One thing is, there's a couple rules here. One, don't do it in public because this is shaming somebody. And when you shame somebody and you put them into a corner with your anger, they're going to come out with their claws out, ready to rip your eyes out. So one is to do it one-on-one. It's to take the flack personally and not make it that they have to save face. So that's one aspect. The other one is focus on the acts that they did that violated what's acceptable to you, not them as a person. And so when I approached this, it's happened several times, approached this person one-on-one and saying, listen, you know, I have female students and I know you know your reputation. I'm going to tell you, raising three daughters, it pisses me off to hear that not once, twice, but four separate times I've heard of you sleeping with your grad students. And I confronted them to this. They've got nowhere to go. There's no one else there except, and I said, it's just me and you alone in a room. I'm not asking you to make amends. I'm not asking you to apologize. I'm saying I'd like to see it, me never hearing about this again, because the next time it might not be one-on-one. It might be in a larger forum. It's unacceptable behavior. And what happens? I've never heard an incident since, and they actually are not at my university.
Of course.
So this
you
is
know,
about...
But you've created a straw man, Todd. I'll tell you why. Because on that particular instance, because the societal zeitgeist is so strongly in your favor, that of course you can get away with being angry because it's righteous anger about oppression of women. That's easy. What if it was the other way around? What if it was, for example, as a professor at university, and you noticed that the admissions criteria for graduate students was not purely merit-based, but there were other factors that were getting in the way, and you decided to use exactly the same degree of righteous pissed-offness, to use your term, to address that, wouldn't you incur far greater risk?
The risk is greater, and one of the other important principles about using anger effectively is... And you use the word righteous indignation or a piece of that. And that's kind of what we're talking about is I don't think it's a straw man because I think, you know, first of all, if you think about women in business, we're not as if the problem has been solved. So there's no straw man there. Some issues will carry more weight and risk than other ones. The question is it something that you deeply value that you're willing to use political capital on? And I don't think people think about this enough. I think people think about I don't want to feel uncomfortable. Why would I rock the boat? And then they don't think to themselves, what do I stand for? What is my life about? What do I want my legacy to be? What would I want my kids to hear about me if they heard the story of what I accomplished at work? And most of the things that we accomplish are, I mean, everything that I write, all my science, within 50 years, no one will remember anything I've ever done before. It'll be completely, you know, immersed in everything else that's been discovered in the next 50 years. How you make an impact is persuading and influencing people. And this is where these tools of, you know, anger and being seductive and sometimes using kindness in a slightly manipulative way, sometimes doing dishes, not when nobody at work is there, if you have like one of those kitchens, but to ensure you do it when other people are there so people know that you get credit for it. But there's these innocuous manipulations to build capital so that you can use it on a rainy day when you are faced with these issues that are a little bit toxic, such as I have a conservative view where I'm not into affirmative action at this level, and I do want to speak my piece, but people will respect me enough because they've seen that I have goodwill. And that goes back to your first question, which is, we need lots of kindness and gratitude and compassion. And part of that reason is because sometimes people will do things that deviate from what we like, what we care about, and we want to be able to have the capital to do something about it.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Todd Kashtan. He's the senior author of a new book called The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, that is sometimes angry, sometimes manipulative, sometimes even narcissistic, as you're going to see, may actually drive success, especially in the workplace and outside. I invite you now, my dear listeners, to give a call. I'd particularly be interested in your efforts when you have used your dark side, whether it be anger or anxiety or invoking guilt or had the narcissistic drive to say, I believe this is brilliant and this is right. I'm going to push forward, and even if I have to be dominating over the group, I'm going to do it. I'd like to hear what your experience has been in using those negative emotions. Have they worked for you? What lessons have you learned? What advice would you have for the rest of us? Or, of course, your question for my guest, Todd Kashtan. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Todd, you say that happy people are at a disadvantage in many aspects of work life, in dealing with details, in deciding whom to trust, in changing people's opinions. That's what authority figures do all the time. That's kind of surprising. Well, how are happy people at a disadvantage?
I mean, it's the reason you had to write this book is the science has been there, and a lot of it's been done in Australia for decades, and no one's put all the pieces together to give to the public. It's, what we know is when you're in a slightly unhappy mood, right? A little bit somber, a little bit sad, a little bit, you're just not fully yourself. When you're in that mood, you end up being more persuasive when you're speaking to other people. And the reason is very simple, is when we're happy, we're comfortable with the status quo. Our brains kind of shut off in some ways. And we're much more superficial in terms of the information that we take in because we're kind of where we want to be. We're satisfied, we're content, and we're going through the motions. Why rock the boat? When we have a little bit of discontent, when we speak to people and try to persuade them, we use more vivid, specific examples. We pay more attention in terms of the parts of the brain that are about filtering information in the moment. They're much more active. And so if you saw somebody steal someone's wallet 50 yards away from you and one person was in a happy mood and you were in a little bit of an uncomfortable mood, you would be more attentive to details in terms of the color of that person's skin, the length of their hair, whether or not they're wearing a scarf, and whether they're wearing shoes or boots. And when you're happy, you just take in like, oh my God, something bad happened. And we're much more superficial. So that's one piece. And it goes with detecting deception in terms of reading people's facial cues. You know, you just think about the last time you were with your romantic partner. And if you were in a pissy mood, you know, you would say to them, why are you giving me that look? Like, you keep saying you're agreeing with me, but I can look at your eyes. And something about you is saying you don't agree with me. You pick up the subtleties that you don't pick up when you're in an unhappy mood. And we've got decades of research to show this.
Of course, this show focuses on work, so I like when we stay pretty focused on that. I'm on a relatively short leash on this show, and so I do like to keep it pretty much on work. I notice every time, in almost every other sentence in what you've just said, you use the word a little bit. Nobody could argue being a little bit, you know, negative, that is, being aware of possible areas for growth. It gets more interesting. There, in almost every... In this is a judgment based on intuition and anecdotal empiricism, not studies. But it seems to me that every group is well served by having most people having a generally positive attitude, and then one or two stuff disturbers who is always feels that indeed just maintaining the status quo doesn't get us anywhere. Growth occurs by identifying the negative and boldly proposing a bold new direction. But that's not being a bit negative. It is being the designated stuff disturber. Does the research support the value of a not just a bit negative person, but somebody who generally is the stuff disturber?
Yes and no. So let's keep this focused on the workplace. Yep. I would suggest that for everyone, depending, if you're talking about a task that requires you to analyze details, you're talking about having to judge something, you're talking about determining who's accountable for something, delegating tasks. These are very analytical things. You have to figure out what are someone's strengths, what are their weaknesses, and how do I leverage people together to create the best teams and the best matches for people for tasks. It is better to be in a non-happy mood when you're doing that. And judges, for example, actual judges, police officers, they're being in a mood that's a little bit less than positive is more helpful for what they're doing. Now, if it ends up being that you're talking about a crossing guard, it's better to be in a happy mood. If you're talking about a librarian, and getting kids to read, it's better to be in a good mood. If you're talking about customer service in the front lines, it's better to be in a good mood. But if you're talking about spreadsheets, you're talking about figuring out whether to consolidate with another company to do a merger, you're talking about making sure what the competitors are doing, whether what you're doing is really creative, has the potential for innovation, you want people, not just a designated sentinel, a designated neurotic. You want people to be in a mood that matches to grab, to harness the strengths at the best. The analytical skills will come out more when there's a little bit less enthusiasm, cheerfulness, and, you know, pep rally mentality in the room.
So said another way, if I am, let's say, a manager or a leader in an organization, let's take a nonprofit. Many of our listeners are very nonprofit oriented here in San Francisco. So I am if I am a person with some responsibility in that nonprofit, I would certainly, if I'm choosing the graphic designer, sure, I want somebody who's upbeat and positive or whatever, or somebody who's putting on the event, who's the gala, the fundraising gala. Sure, I want somebody who's going to roll with the punches and be positive and not look for the negative. But if I'm looking to see if I'm going to merge, for example, UCSF has just merged with Children's Hospital or Children's Hospitals. If I am in charge or involved in that merger, I am going to want to assign somebody to that who is worried about every little thing with that can go wrong in terms of patient care, in terms of union issues, in terms of everything. Is it really that it's correct? And I think you did cite one study that said that for analytical tasks, you want, in general, the worrywart, the negative person, the not happy-chappy person to do it. And if you're looking for something that is really kind of just incrementally changing the status quo, as in doing the graphic design, you want somebody who's more positive. Is that correct?
No, that's exactly right. And there's actually even a nice, cool word for it for the workplace, which is defensive pessimists. And these aren't people that are think the world is going to fall and all they're going to do is grouse about everything they hate about, you know, administrative assistants, athletic teams, and their friends. Defensive pessimists, and this is so fundamental to your listeners, these are people that brace for the worst and hope for the best.
Right.
They think about all the catastrophic things that can go wrong. They get anxious. But that anxiety is not something you want to get rid of. That's how they psych themselves up to imagine all the different ways that I could deal with all the different ways that can go wrong. If you try to turn them into optimists, and we see these people right now, they're happiness consultants, and you've got all these books about the happy workplace that are coming in. You try to change a defensive pessimist, you steal their superpowers.
Absolutely.
They will figure out what could go wrong in the future that we don't know what's going to happen, and prepare actionable plans for all those different catastrophic possible scenarios.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
There's a whole happiness industry here, the whole positive psychology industry, which is, you know, and mindfulness and happiness is all so suffused. And, you know, adjacent to the Bay Area here is Silicon Valley. And there it operates exactly the opposite. One of the most respected icons in Silicon Valley was the founder of Intel, Andy Grove. And he, after 30 years, he wrote his memoir, and he called it Only the Paranoid Survive. Because indeed it is that the having your antenna out and worrying about the next threat, the next possibility, it costs a person his life. No one is saying that it is salubrious, that it is the key to long life. No, you'll live a lot longer if you're chirpy. Many studies show that in general, although there's been a recent one contrary to that. But if you are interested in, quote, making a difference, leaving a legacy, if that is primary, it is, I believe, one of the most underrated attributes of all is the worry wart. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, and I'll actually, let me give you another person. It's my favorite biography of any person in business, Lee Iacocca from Ford. And he has
Chrysler.
This rule, which I think people should follow, which is he always told people that work under him, I don't want to meet with anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody on the phone. I want to see it in writing so I could divorce the ideas from their excitement about their ideas. And that fits with the principles that we're talking about, which is we're not interested in how excited and optimistic you are about your ideas. We first want to evaluate the ideas themselves. And in particularly American culture, and particularly in Silicon Valley, there's this idea of this enthusiastic cheerfulness
right.
means that we confuse because something feels good,
right.
it must be good.
Right.
That's called the halo effect. And
yeah.
we don't, We don't want that in the business world.
Right. And I watch Shark Tank, that CNBC show, periodically, and you see these chirpy people in weird costumes with endless enthusiasm, but then their ideas, when the experts, you know, start to ask hard questions, they wither in their cheerleaderness, they drop their pom-poms very quickly. Typically.
Yeah, you know, it's great. I watched it with my 8-year-old twins, my girls, and they love that show. And actually, that's a really good point, is it almost manipulates us, the viewer, in that we start rooting for them before the experts chime in. And then it's like, oh my God, they're not rooting for the person who was my fan favorite. And it's a great lesson that should be distilled, which is the ideas should have their own merit. And one thing that we know is you are actually more persuasive when you're sober, because it's, yes, I might like you in terms of your representation, but that doesn't mean I'm going to buy from you. Actually, I can think of specific products on Shark Tank. It was a very somber, clear, vivid examples of how would this be useful for me in my household or in my work team for the thing that you're offering. And that's what sold me, not whether or not you were smiling and you were laughing and you made me laugh.
In fact, you know, and when I watch any talking head on TV, those that are too enthusiastic, it almost implies they need to inject a measure of this emotion to compensate for the lack of intellectual rigor. If someone is concise, brief, really presents an airtight logical argument without a lot of emotion, I'm more likely to buy their idea, whether we're talking politics or we're talking products. That makes sense?
Yeah, it's interesting, because we did do a lot of research around the world that in Russia and Japan, for example, that's exactly how they feel about American business people.
Right.
Is if you come in with a cheerful demeanor, immediately you lost about 20%
Bingo.
Of interest in what you're talking about.
Bingo. It's really an example of the artifice, of the superficial. It's like when somebody walks into your office with a 3-piece pinstripe suit, alligator shoes, and a fancy attaché case, you're thinking, what is going on here? You know, this is feeling a little bit like more sizzle than steak.
Right.
Let's go to the phones. We have people being very patient waiting for us. We're having a good conversation. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with my guest Todd Kashtan, the author of The Upside of Your Dark Side. What is your question or comment for him?
Okay, comment. I am the worry ward who sweats the small stuff. Just had a recent anger incident less than 2 weeks ago, and I'm still trying to come up with a proper email response to this. But so just to cut to the quick story here, I'm an office manager for a group of doctors in a university hospital. And onboarding a new doctor, I had to have a bunch of stuff ready, their paperwork, their business cards, you know, their place they're going to be, their office, et cetera. And one of those little components for that is their sign, you know, with the doctor name on it for the door. And the department that does this, the workplace services, wasn't answering all my emails about, hey, where is this thing? This doctor is starting on Monday. I'm supposed to have this. And all I got was on the Friday before the Monday, it should be here Monday. I got a one-sentence answer. That made me go ballistic and then send an answer back saying, you know, you need to call your vendor and verify this sign is going to be here, or else if it's not here Monday by noon, I'm going to have to talk to my manager, who's going to have to go to your manager. And that's about as angry as I would get in an email, basically to sort of make him look at this and, hey, answer me.
Your thoughts,
so,
Todd?
Monday, noon comes, and this person actually shows up at my door. And he's a staff person, a temporary worker, who said that, you're trying to get me in trouble, here's your sign, you're unkind. And my only answer to him was, we were talking in the hallway, I didn't want to cause a disturbance, and he was getting a little animated, and I said, well, just answer your emails, I don't know what you're doing, I need this stuff. And he's like, you're trying to get me in trouble, you're unkind, and he storms off. Well, I still haven't replied, and my department manager is also a stickler who doesn't like any disharmony, so I'm still trying to formulate an email to this guy basically saying, in lieu of a complaint to your boss about your unprofessional behavior, let me tell you about how unkind you are to me when I don't know if my project's going to happen on time.
Todd, any reactions?
No, I mean, I empathize. I think all of us have been through these scenarios where someone is much more reactive to something we said or didn't say than we ever anticipated. I think the important thing, what I love about your description is you have time to respond, which is, this is one of those scenarios as we get older versus being in the middle school lunchroom, which is, this is all about lose the battle, win the war, right? Which is, you might be 100% right, and you know what? The person, they're reactive, they're upset, and so we just let ourselves lose the battle, and we apologize for something. It's almost like a false apology, but it's okay though. You know, we apologize, we acknowledge that, like, listen, I could have worded things better. I was quicker and more abrupt than I would have wanted to. It might have been the time of day. Regardless, it's on me. I'm sorry. I really appreciate the work that you did.
No. I don't want to apologize at all.
Caller, that is the great dilemma of working in an organization. Most corporate, you know, unless you're in certain cultures, maybe in New York City, it might be different. But here in the Bay Area, there is such a primacy of being nice. Down underneath the surface, people are people. They're going to be nice. They're going to be monstrous, whatever. But there is such a primacy of being nice that if you are not, you're going to get fired. You're going to pay the price. That just doesn't. You win the battle, yes, by invoking some guilt. But you have it a couple more times. You already said your boss loves harmony. Well, you know what? Most bosses love harmony, because at any major corporation, including the major hospital chain that I suspect you're associated with, it is a massive bureaucracy with massive rules, and everybody's being pulled in every way to just meet the all the stupid little detail requirements. You go and you object to it, you broke up the harmony, and you're going to pay the price. Do you think that's a fair assumption?
Well, my response that I'm planning is actually not an angry one, but just one to say how I would handle this customer service situation. I would have responded to a customer who was obviously anxious that, their project wouldn't come to pass, and just communication would have altered this whole thing.
You know what? I think I'm going to ask Todd his opinion, but you know what? I'd let it go. I think the upside of you drumming your point, remember, you are just a kind of a low-level guy here in this very big organization with a bunch of doctors.
Right.
What if I said you're smart at this point, like Todd was implying? You don't want to, you've already made your point once. You're unlikely to change that organization system. It's better in this case to shut up. Todd, what do you think?
No. That's exactly what I was saying, which is that, I mean, you've expressed your anger to him, and what you learn stuff. It's okay to be angry in the moment with that person. It was angry and they didn't deliver. What you realize is you now have a very fragile, reactive person, and you're not seeing them on a day-to-day basis. If you were, I would say, similar to what I said before, talk to them one-on-one, no public audience, no video, no email, so there's no written record, and say, listen, this is not how you communicate to me. Like, this, you will not work with me and treat me anything less than someone that you treat of someone who, whatever group you think is important, people with PhDs or not, it's not how you communicate to me. You will not get anywhere. But because you already recognize this is a very fragile person and you've already expressed anger, I would say, again, lose the battle, win the war when it comes to this.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. Let's move on a little bit. I wrote for another radio station. They asked me to write these two and a half minute tips, career tips, and one of them bears directly on this issue. I call this the Why Negativity is Key to Your Success. So I'd like, Todd, I'm going to read you my little 2 minute essay, and then I'd like to hear your comments about it. Okay?
Yeah, I love it.
Great. Okay, many bosses focus on the positive, because when an employee gets a poor evaluation, the reaction is not, thanks for the feedback, I'll work to improve. It's not that, it's defensiveness and sometimes a legal grievance. True, praise reinforces desired behaviors, but it can also make a person complacent. And it certainly doesn't provide the feedback a person needs to improve. And criticism can be motivating. Now it's clear, if I don't improve, I'm going to lose my job. I better do something. Well, here are some examples of criticism being motivating. A 250-pound woman named Ciara Sweatman, wearing a Hooters T-shirt, was told, "You don't look like any Hooters girl I've ever seen." Well, that criticism was what finally motivated her to lose weight, 128 pounds to be precise, after which she got hired as a waitress, as you guessed it, at Hooters. a high school counselor told Phil Padrid, who had done poorly in school, that you're not college material, and you should consider getting a job at the post office. Well, he's now a veterinarian. Job seekers also suffer from the lack of criticism. They work hard to apply for a job and usually get no response or a form letter rejection that provides no feedback, only the useless, "We had many qualified candidates, sorry." We should also honor, not denigrate, well-meaning criticizers. This is back to what we were talking about earlier. How feeble are we that we are swayed more by dubious flattery than by valid suggestions? We should stop criticizing the well-intentioned critic. He's not negative or a curmudgeon. He's good at finding areas to improve and is caring and brave enough to suggest them. We should also make candid feedback the workplace norm. Famed GE CEO Jack Welch installed a culture at GE that emphasizes honest feedback, and the GE employees appreciate that they get to work with only good performers, and no one was surprised when they got let go, and GE improved. For example, when Welch came to GE, its refrigerators were at the bottom of the Consumer Reports rating, and when he left, they were at the top. And finally, we should seek out criticism. People will respect your willingness to ask for feedback, especially if you ask well. For example, you might ask your boss and coworker something like, "I'm trying to keep growing. I'd really appreciate candid feedback on where I'm doing well and where I might improve." Now, of course, you can't be negative too often, but if you're too chirpy, maybe it's time to change your tune a bit. And then I said, with today's career tip, I'm Marty Nemko. So that was my little two-minute essay. What reactions do you have to that?
I mean, well, first of all, send it to me. I mean, your essay is exactly comparable to what we talked about. We right now have a culture, we call it comfort addiction, mm-hmm. which is, it's the enemy of ambition. And if you can't tolerate negative emotions, you cannot cultivate skills. You cannot learn how to delay gratification and work on things where it's hard now to get better later. And I mean, I agree with everything you say. Edward Catmull talks about this exact same thing with Pixar, which is if you are interested in growing and being at the best at your craft and becoming a master at something, then you have to receive constructive feedback. And if our goal is to create people that are mere simulacrums and clones of ourselves, we're going to get nothing but decent to good work, but never great work. I mean, you need people to tell you what's bad, and you can't talk about compliment sandwiches because then people won't pay attention to it. You actually have to highlight, bold, and italicize the thing that people did wrong, and they're going to walk away uncomfortable, and they might attach it to you. And what you hope from the people that you hire is that 48 hours later, they say, "You know what? That was the best feedback, finally, I've ever received in my career." But you're willing to absorb the 48 hours, or someone might like you a lot less than you would have hoped. And that's part of being a good leader.
Here is the barrier.
So I totally agree with you.
Here is the barrier that exists. This all implies that the highest good in the life well led is productivity, excellence, or whatever. But if there is a mantra that is hegemonic here in the Bay Area, it's probably work-life balance. Seek happiness. It has its roots in the 60s movement of screw authority, screw corporations, sex, drugs, rock and roll, Woodstock, the Beatles, etc. And so the primacy of pleasure is antithetical to wanting to get negative feedback and working on it and growing or whatever. How does one really step out of your academic role into the human being? Let's say, you know, you talked about your twin daughters. Let's say they were a little older and they had embodied what is the dominant societal ethos, which is about work-life balance, etc., in this country. And that's part of, by the reason why we do so much offshoring to Asia, where work is more primary. But if your daughters were now at age 20 and they were in college and they were embracing the work-life balance ethos, especially with the emphasis on life, what would you actually say to them to get them more open to both receiving the negative and being negative as key to the life well-led?
Well, Marty, I mean, I'm not just an academic. I'm the guy who works with Gap Customs Border Protection, the CIA. I'm actually doing the organizational consulting of exactly this kind of stuff. When it comes to my kids, let me give you actually a better...
Now, talk about the Gap. You know, I actually was a consultant to the Gap myself, so I know that culture damn well. Tell me, and that is a very positive, upbeat, chirpy culture there. Is that not correct?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And what we did was work with the idea of what do you expect will happen if someone was to tell you exactly, exactly how they feel about your strengths and weaknesses, but clearly your weaknesses, and they're going to explicitly tell you examples of things that they were surprised that this is how you perform, this is how you act, and this is how you do, and it doesn't fit in with what works well in terms of creativity, innovation, ambition, growth, and being flexible in an environment where we never know what's going to be next in a flat world where you have global competition. And we actually did exercise where people gave them direct feedback after a 10-minute conversation on a bizarre topic and gave them feedback, strengths and weaknesses, ending with weaknesses. And what you found was people found it refreshing, and they said, this is unlike anything I get at the workplace. Mm-hmm. And we talked about what would it be if your feedback was not an annual feedback session, but every time you did something really amazing or any time you did something that was just stupid, you receive feedback one-on-one with other people. And people said, I would find work to be more engaging. I didn't mind it. I felt uncomfortable, but I feel like I'm stronger because of it. And this is the common response. But let me add one more piece, Marty. This is so important, and this is relevant to the workplace. People think that if they show vulnerability in terms of someone exposes things I'm not good at, or I show that I'm anxious, or I'm uncomfortable, or I don't know if I can deliver, that's antithetical for what a great worker does. What you soon realize is that vulnerability draws people to you. You know, when people are anxious when they give a talk, all it does is make them human. And when Jon Stewart on his comedy show laughs at his own jokes, which is the worst thing a comedian is supposed to do, that's him at his best. That's when people love him. He's making the cardinal mistake of a comedian. Keep it together, like Stephen Colbert usually does, right? But that's what makes him attractive. That's what makes you human and vulnerable is what draws people in, not by being superhuman and perfect in all places. And that's being exposing the places where you're uncomfortable and where you have a little bit self-doubt and a little bit less self-assuredness than you would like. That's so, where the action is.
Self-deprecation is that's unarguable. That's not controversial. Indeed, Johnny Carson, you spoke about comedians, well, in previous generation, Johnny Carson, half his jokes weren't that funny. But what he would do is he would make this sheepish, nice, Midwestern, humble, self-deprecating look in response to the joke, and he got a bigger laugh from that self-deprecating response. The question is, picture yourself, Todd, really think about yourself, let's say right now. You are a new assistant professor at George Mason. You do not have tenure, a first-year person. And let's say you and there are these interminable and endless faculty meetings, and you are there and you are adopting feedback-oriented approach. So you were really well prepared for all the meetings, and so, you know, when people made proposals, you asked really hard negative questions. You were realizing that growth doesn't come from so much being happy and positive. Do you think you would have gotten tenure as easily?
If my colleagues were on the phone lines right now, they would tell you that's exactly what describes how I was like when I came here. And I had a lot of friction, but I'm also one of the youngest full professors here at Mason. But that, and I tell students this now, which is you need to speak your piece when it fits with the core things that you care about. Because assume that 20% of people will dislike you. I mean, this is a common business wisdom. If everyone likes your idea and it's left of center, it's not left of center. It's like you've just hit it right down the middle. You're doing what everyone else is doing. Accept an 80-20, that 20% will disagree with you. And I've always accepted that. I mean, I got that from working on Wall Street. If 20% disagree with you, I'm comfortable with having just a few good friends. And that's been my strategy all through my entire life, and I've gotten tons of friction, and thank God I have like a really, you know, really nice, compassionate wife who's always there for hearing me complain about things. But that's the path. Great, passionate work is doing things that create friction.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm having a ball talking with what feels like a kindred spirit, Todd Kashdan. I know I end my shows always by saying we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. I will admit that I'm finding a fair amount of comfort. He is the author of The Upside of Your Dark Side, subtitle, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Quote-Unquote Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. You even say, you know, and my background is Jewish, and we're notorious parents as parents for using guilt as a motivator. You're saying that guilt in the workplace is one of those negative emotions that actually is underrated, underused. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, when we experience guilt, when we recognize that we did something wrong, and we want to rectify our behavior in some way, but we feel better. We actually feel uncomfortable. We want to like kind of shy away from the world for a little bit. I mean, we want to kind of hide our face, make avoid eye contact. I mean, what we know is people that go through jail and prison that feel more guilty about their crimes, there's about 2 to 3 times less recidivism. And the same thing in terms of antisocial behavior at work. If it involves stealing people's ideas or stealing files off of the computer, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you know, stealing Willy Wonka's goods and selling them on the side, slugs. Guilt prevents those antisocial acts. And when we create an environment where we don't allow people to experience guilt, we don't tell them that, listen, what you did, not you, you're not a bad person, but what you did is just totally asinine. Like, you just screwed up that meeting. You just, because of the things that you said in that meeting, you gave away all of the relationship building we've been doing for 6 months. If you don't tell people that and let them experience guilt, not for being a bad person, but for a bad action, you're missing an opportunity for growth that comes through discomfort.
You know what I'm going to do right now? I'm going to take you up on the, you know, you say how great negativity is. Well, I'm going to give you some negative feedback right now. Do you know that you mispronounced 2 words? You've done it twice. It's not recognize. That's very blue-collar ways. It's recognize. And so I really think that if you're a bright guy and all that, and I don't want you to be prematurely dismissed because of pronunciation. You also use the word somber. You called it somber or something. It's somber. So I'd like to invite you to consider working on that. Is that acceptable negative feedback?
If you had seen me right now, because it's so rare, I've given hundreds of interviews in my career. No one's ever done this before. I'm smiling. I'm just to have a tit-for-tat organic exchange where you give me constructive feedback and I'm supposed to be the quote-unquote expert, that's great. I mean, cause I'm not done growing. I have no desire to ever end growing. So, and actually, I never knew that. So that's fantastic.
Okay, dude, well, let's be fair. Now, why don't you, and use whatever techniques you think are appropriate, why don't you give me a criticism? Let's not call it a challenge or, you know, we always say there's no problems, there's challenges. We don't criticize. We offer areas for growth. Why don't you give me a criticism?
Sure. I mean, I think when your callers call in, I think one of the more important things to do is if you're going to ask for me to spend my time to be on this radio show, for me to give them feedback, is to suspend what you're going to say next and listen to my response and build off of it, yes and, because what happened was rather repetitive in terms of your feedback which tells me you kind of didn't listen to what I said.
You're right. I was not good. You're right. I screwed up. You're absolutely right. I wasn't quite listening well enough, and so I rationalized that I was being adding to what you said, but you're right. I didn't listen well enough. Thanks, dude. All right, let's go on. Great. So now you say that even narcissism, your book, by the way, The Upside of Your Dark Side, says that even narcissism, which is like the dirtiest of all words in the Bay Area, especially where community is everything, collaboration, teamwork. Narcissism, you say, can even have value in the workplace. Explain that.
Absolutely. So let me just give a, because I am a big fan of language. There's two different types of narcissism. One is actually horrific for the business environment, and one is really good. And it's important to distinguish the two. So one is the bad one. Is we'll call it narcissistic rivalry. And that's to strive for supremacy, to strive to be better than all of these rivals you've created, to be the best person on your team, the one that gets the most attention, the most gold stars and badges. And so when you have this sense of this desire to be supreme, it makes you have conflicts with people, not to be good at your craft, but to be better than everybody else. And so that type of style is problematic when it comes to developing a cooperative team, because it's really about the group and the product versus the world. Can we make it the best product? You get annoyed when you're criticized. You don't want your rivals to do well, and so you'll sabotage them in some ways. You won't share ideas. That's problematic. The good part of narcissism is called narcissistic admiration, and this is when people strive to be unique. You know, one of the things about being creative that people always miss when they try to, these happiness consultants come into corporations, the first stage to creating a creative work climate is people have to want to be creative. Now, being creative means you're doing something that's different from what other people are doing, and that new thing also has utility. And so it means you're going to experience friction. These people that have this desire for admiration, the desire to be unique, they use their charminess, they use their kindness to win allies. They'll do tit for tat strategies, which is, listen, I'll back you up on this meeting for your idea if you'll back me up later. They believe they have special strength. They deserve extra attention. They believe that they can draw people's attention to them, that they're very interesting. But here's the key part about narcissistic admiration. They're not bad people. It's not a bad strategy. It's just that because they're motivated to use their strengths and leverage other people to create greatness. And if you try to take away their narcissism and tell them to be selfless, to focus on the I and not the team, their strengths will come to the forefront. Their strengths of being charming, of willing to go against the grain just to see what happens, willing to be the devil's advocate because they believe that they have a different perspective on things, it makes the team better. And if there's a willingness to absorb the fact that these people like conflict to create great work, going to make the team better.
Yeah. What if I said that actually even the kind of narcissism you derided, that is, because I want to be better, because I want to be the best, I want to show that I'm better than the others. While yes, it can have a negative side effect of, you know, perhaps especially if they're denigrating the other person and they're sabotaging. Of course, I'm not defending that. But look at all the salespeople. Every study of successful salespeople finds that they are driven by a desire to be the best, to beat their sales quota by the most, to compete. Every sports event is if we took away competition, which we do in our schools all the time, you would lose half the motivation. Is it not, as long as the eventual outcome is much more positive than negative, can't we even legitimate the narcissism that is purely grounded in, I want to be the best, I want to beat the other guys?
This call is now being recorded.
First of all, we are very kindred souls here about the schools and the need for competition. It still falls under admiration, what you're describing. There's other people there, but the desire is, I want to be the best. So the motivation is to make people see how special and amazing that I am and figure out a way to bring that to the forefront.
Okay. So let's see where we're going to need to kind of bring things toward toward a conclusion. Again, I'm always trying to I love having guests on the show whose ideas are dissonant with the conventional wisdom. And certainly in the Bay Area, one of the most, again, revered of the attributes in the way in going through life is mindfulness. That is gentle observing rather than judging or being emotionally reactive. And you're saying, yeah, that indeed mindfulness can be valuable at work. But you also talk about unconsciousness raising. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to ask off record, because almost nobody, I mean, we interview tons of senators, congressmen, peak athletes, Olympians, Navy SEALs. Nobody wants to go on record for these kind of information about the when they use their gut instinct, when they're narcissistic. But all of the top players, people at peak performance, use this. When you deviate from mindfulness and you're talking about being mindless, about using your gut instincts, where you don't really know why, but this doesn't feel right. It's just your intelligence on speed. It's based on years of training. And if you were to ask the top CEOs, CFOs, football head coaches, I mean, they'll tell you they have gut instincts when they see players. They have gut instincts about what plays to use. And it's not just random. It comes from that we can't process all the information in a situation. And when there's a situation where there's a ton of information and we need a rapid response, here's what I'm suggesting, is that going the mindless route, quick responding, is better than mindfully contemplating and being in the present moment and using a Ben Franklin pros and cons table to figure out what works best in a situation that wastes a lot of energy and time, and you're probably not going to get an outcome as good as a quick gut decision.
And yet quick gut decisions are precisely what are being absolutely criticized endlessly by the media, by civil rights groups, when the police and have to make those split-second instant decisions about whom to stop, who headed a shoot, whatever, and disproportionately it's unquestioned that African Americans are shot more, you know, whether it's because they are more guilty or whatever it is, we don't, let's put that to another day. But the question really is that gut feeling, even though Malcolm Gladwell in the book Blink honored that exact point, that the mental computer that is our brain takes into account millions of factors in those first 1 or 2 seconds we meet somebody. But isn't it very dangerous, especially in these racially sensitive times, to be encouraging gut thinking when the CEO or anybody else meets somebody for the first time?
You know, I'm so glad you brought this up. So I'm going to avoid the race topic in general. But let me just say this. When we live in a culture where everyone is the Monday morning quarterback, everywhere, every place. But what we don't hear in the media, and this is so important, is you don't hear about the times where something didn't happen, that went awry, where something didn't go awry. All of the times that someone on the front lines, whether it's a firefighter, police officer, or someone at Customs and Border Patrol, where nothing wrong happened, which means something good happened. A threat was averted. A threat was handled. You take away someone's gut instincts of a decade of training and really hard boot camp in the first year to get people up to speed, to have those gut instincts, to understand how to respond to shadows, how to respond when you have an officer down, how to respond when you're by yourself or you have someone at your side. You take that away by having them second guess. And you lose all of the intellect and the skills and the wisdom and the strengths that we just spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and all these years training in the first place. We now have people on the front lines who are second guessing. And that is potentially, I'm saying, much more dangerous in terms of number of lives than what we're focusing on right now.
I'm going to interrupt you because we're out of time, but I have this call who's been waiting forever. I want to say one thing. You make a great point that I didn't want to go away. When you are trying to think of a problem, what you're supposed to do is, if it's a complex problem, think about it and then do something else for a minute or two so you can kind of view it again with fresh eyes and then use your gut feeling. That's a really nice model. Let's see if we can get somebody to make a very quick comment or question. What's your quick question or comment? We are just out of time. I just wanted to get to you, though.
That's okay, Marty. This is Rose Tess.
Hello.
My question changes every second that you're talking to this interesting person. Mm-hmm. But basically, it has to do with feeling like you've got all the right answers and how to get beyond that and being, because of that, seeming like the troublemaker or the person who is always the devil's advocate.
Great question. Give us a 15-second quick answer if you can. Todd?
Oh, I mean, she's absolutely right. I mean, the death of knowledge, wisdom, and strength is assuming taking the title of being an expert or a guru. We always want to be a lifelong learner. And we have to create a culture where even the highest people at the hierarchy have to treat it as someone on the ground level could have as much wisdom as them for a particular situation, how to solve a problem.
And I would add to that that everybody is not the same. Some people really are know-it-alls in a given area. They do know more than everybody. Often we don't. So it is making that one-size-does-not-fit-all generalization that I think is probably the wise way to go. Anyway, and certainly a wise way to go would be to read the book, The Upside of Your Dark Side. It is a really, as you can see, a pretty mind-blowing book. It blows up conventional wisdom about the valuing of chirpiness in the workplace. There is a place for that. That and for the negative. Todd Kashdan, thank you so much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Oh, thanks for being the first person to criticize me on the air in the moment.
All right, you take care and be well. I will send you that essay as you asked for. All right. That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, David LaTulipe, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday. Don't have time to tell you what it's going to be. Great show, I swear. It's about Buddhism in the workplace. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 7 books, including How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's martynemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on KALW San Francisco.